Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Welcome to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by the Rebeller Podcast Network. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, the editor-in-chief of Rebeller. I am joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you guys today?
Well, how are you?
Doing great.
Before we get started on this week's show, I want to tell you all a bit about RebellerMedia.com. RebellerMedia.com is a one-stop shop for all your film writing needs. Every day, I and my crack team of editors will be gathering the most interesting movie news and essays on the web for you to browse through. Think of us a bit like the Drudge Report for Hollywood. After you are done checking out the day's headlines, we hope you will stick around and enjoy some Rebeller originals. In the first week or so, we're going to have S. Craig Zahler talking about some of his favorite graphic novels. We'll have an essay from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood editor Fred Raskin on Sally Menke, who was the steady editing hand behind Quentin Tarantino's rise to prominence. The great Matt Labash will weigh in on Marvel vs. Marty, and Rebeller's own Dave Spielman will be lighting fires on the reg. We're paying good people good money for the content you're enjoying, including the content you're enjoying right now, so we hope you will sign up for a membership. That's how we keep this thing going. It'll give you unlimited access. It's either $1.99 per month or $20.19 for the whole year. And now on to the show. First up in controversies and nontroversies. As a wise man once put it, who controls the past now controls the future. Who controls the present now controls the past. And in the age of digital erasure and creation, it's never been easier to control the past or the present in an effort to shape the future. Outrage mounted when it was announced that a film studio and an effects company planned on using a digital likeness of James Dean for a Vietnam War movie. Why won't they let the dead rest? Who's going to show him the respect he deserves? Meanwhile, Disney Plus has excised uncomfortable bits of its history, withholding Song of the South from its new streaming channel, and removing Simpsons episode Stark Raving Dad from that title's catalog. As we all remember, that is the episode in which Michael Jackson makes a guest appearance. It was, you know, it was all very, very sweet and touching, but also a little bit weird now because of all the boy touching. On top of that, trigger warnings that the studio is adding to older cartoon movies, telling audiences that the movies contain outdated cultural depictions. And you add all that together, it's been a banner couple of weeks for mucking about with the past. Now, both of these developments point to the promise and peril of our digital future, I think. We can bring stars back to life, and we can erase everything about them that makes us uncomfortable all at the same time. Alyssa, What could possibly go wrong with corporate Big Brother at the helm here?
So much. I mean, actors should be frustrated about this, not least because they may be put fully out of work. I mean, if you can just resurrect James Dean and Marlon Brando, why do you need many of our sort of mid-level, not terribly high value of a replacement actors?
Do digital ghosts get SAG minimum?
I don't know. That's a good question. The only ghost that I'm in favor of reviving is Barbara Stanwyck because she is awesome, and I would watch a Barbara Stanwyck movie like every day.
But here's the thing, though, is that we all have that one person who's awesome, right? That is like, you know, I would watch a movie in which John Wayne is resurrected and, you know, is kind of put into a modern setting, or not even necessarily a modern setting. Another Western with the Coen brothers, maybe. I don't know. There are all sorts of things that I could see being like really neat to see once or twice. And the Pandora's box here is where, you know, where do you actually end it?
Absolutely. And the reason that I'm not incredibly worried about this is because it is not at all clear that digital recreations will be able to make the kind of actorly decisions that make acting distinctive, right? I mean, even with Will Smith in Gemini Man, they recreated a younger version of him, but it's still him behind the digital recreation making the decisions about what expressions to use, how to use his facial muscles, etc. And
mostly him. So, I mean, he is there effectively wearing a digital Will Smith mask.
Right.
But if you read some of the stories about how this was created, they actually did have the artists go in and make some of the decisions about, in particular, his facial expressions of the younger him. And that's not Will Smith. That's a team of people saying, how is this supposed to look based on our reference footage and the complexities of our model?
But are they making a decision that he smiles in a scene when he's actually frowning, etc.? I mean, I think that that kind of like very, very granular decision is going to be hard to just sort of cook up in a lab and make those decisions by committee. I think that's going to be difficult. And I think until that is perfected, and God knows, you know, there will be AI that replace all of us. Actually, the three of us are just like an AI program, podcast program.
We're in a simulation.
All of these will be fed into an AI that spits out a controversies and non-controversies each week. It shouldn't be that hard.
Exactly. So I'm not terribly worried about it in the short term, but certainly from a sort of labor perspective and an interesting performances perspective, if I were an actor, this would be sort of the number one issue that I would want my agency working on. Like, I would want full control of my digital rights. I would be pretty freaked out.
The digital rights thing here is interesting. I frankly find the other part of this question much more concerning. The increasing ease with which corporations can just make stuff go away. Now, Peter, I assume you're in favor of this because since they own it, they should be allowed to do whatever they want with it.
Well, they should be allowed to. I certainly think they should be allowed to. That doesn't mean that they are beyond reproach or criticism at all. And in fact, if there's a market for something, studios are going to see that, and fans should make it known that they would like to purchase a different version of this product. In fact, one of the sort of strangest examples of this,
for instance,
is
the Snyder Cut.
Snyder Cut, which may or may not exist.
It exists.
There's a movie that we know exists, and that's the 1977 original version of Star Wars, which you cannot get in a high quality format right now. Now, in fact, part of the problem has been that Fox owned that even after Disney bought Lucasfilm. Now Disney also owns Fox, and this has been
Robert Iger's long game,
right?
Is
so
to get the original.
We may actually now get this thanks to large corporations
and
their mergers.
Except the only thing we've seen from on this front is another altered version of Star Wars. Of the original Star Wars. There was a big controversy this week because for some reason they added, I legit wonder in my mind is if they uploaded the wrong file. If they uploaded like a digital version that had been tweaked and somebody hadn't been
paying,
why would you just add a random exclamation from Greedo? In 100% serious, the only other explanation is they're doing it to F with people. They're just doing it to mess with people that they know will freak out on Twitter, which they did. Lots of buzz for Disney Plus.
I felt that moment so much more strongly when he says McClunky. It's like it completely amped up the drama. No, look, the Star Wars films are actually an argument for corporate control because a smart big corporation never would have messed with films that are this beloved and never would have messed with them in the way that George Lucas did. That was an auteurist decision to take what he felt like was the thing that he owned and make it something that fans didn't want. And big corporations are going to say, look, maybe we want to mess with it a little bit, but we're not going to take away the original thing. We're not going to take away the revenue line there. And Disney, I think, is probably going to make an effort to bring back some of the unedited, unmessed with versions of Star Wars that people have been demanding for years that George Lucas has consistently said, no, these are mine. I'm not going to. And that's his right. That's totally his right. And I get it. And artists own their works and can mess with them and do whatever they want with them. On the other hand, there's actually there's an argument that big corporations are going to be more responsive to fan demands here than someone like George Lucas, who is worth billions of dollars, is kind of arrogant, in some ways rightly so, and just doesn't feel like he has to respond to those concerns.
But sometimes fan demands are bad.
Yes,
and I think that one of the things that...
For instance, with Sonic. You know, we should have had the original Sonic. This fan-driven decision to get
Sonic
rid of the teeth.
Sonic the Hedgehog, not Sonic the Hamburger. The
Both.
But no, one of the things that you brought up was Disney putting content warnings on some of the films in Disney Plus, or excluding them altogether, as with Song of the South, which, let's be clear, is both racist and kind of unwatchable. But I actually think the content warnings strike the right balance, because mm-hmm. the content is still available. And you can think that the crows in Dumbo are racist, but also a chunk of the movie makes no sense without their presence. And so you preserve the movie in a way that it makes sense, that, you know, also preserves the historical memory that Walt Disney was, you know, not a company that always held the same values or paid attention to the same imperatives. So, and also Walt Disney himself is kind of a nightmare. But let's consumers make a decision. Yep. And I mean... You know, whether or not that warning is making a judgment on the content, we can talk about that. But I think preserving the...
Let's talk about it. Is it? But, is it making a... I think that's an important... I think that's an important thing. I think it's tipping the scales here a little bit against the movie. It's like, it is condescending in a way that I think is not useful to the conversation.
I don't know that that's necessarily the case, because these are kids' movies, right? And it's... I mean... There's a whole another conversation to be had about what's entertainment for kids and young adults and actual adults. But if you're going in to watch a movie with your kids and you haven't watched Dumbo in a million years and like, oh, it's a cute elephant. I mean, Dumbo is a super dark movie, but maybe it's a little reminder to you, okay, this is actually going to bring up something that I might want to talk about with my kids at the end of the movie. I mean, there's nothing wrong with giving people more information.
Well, There are two ways to look at this. One is I don't have a problem with the trigger warnings in the sense that I would prefer a trigger warning to an erasure entirely.
Sure.
I agree with that. I guess the real issue here is I have either a modest amount of contempt for audiences that feel like they need this sort of thing, or I have a modest amount of contempt for the corporations that think the audiences are so stupid they don't understand what they're seeing. Does that make sense? I find it condescending more than anything else. Like, yes, the past is a foreign country. It's very different there. You know, we know that there are some depictions that are not going to be as pleasing today as some people might like.
But I think any content warning can be construed as condescending to someone, right? And I mean,
there are people who
would have, you know, we were talking about Dr. Sleep last week, a movie that I could not make it through. And there are people who would look at a warning about a scene in which a bunch of adults like torture a little kid to death and say like, oh, it's a horror movie. If you can't handle that kind of thing, you know, either suck it up or don't go. I would have appreciated that sort of information going into it. And you can argue about the best way to word this stuff and whether it's neutral. But
what about historical smoking? Are we allowed? But this is the same thing, right? Is when the MPAA puts out a rating, and one of the like warnings underneath it is historical smoking. I get triggered by that. That triggers me because I like see it. I'm like, who cares? Smoking is great. First off, everyone should smoke cigarettes.
But part of the reason that exists is because the tobacco industry had a hugely profitable relationship with Hollywood that was aimed at making cigarette smoking look attractive, right? Some of this is Hollywood attempting
It does look really cool, though.
It looks awesome. Like, let's not lie.
Especially when really attractive people are doing when it
really,
on screen.
While really, doing like, things like walking down a hallway like Peggy Olson quitting their job.
Or
like,
just
come
like,
on.
Or like with the light in the background, you know, filtering through it, making it, you know, like Blade Runner style, giving the, it that ambiance.
Random fog.
But again, there is context for that warning in the entertainment industry's relationship with the tobacco industry. Well,
yeah, but that relationship doesn't exist anymore.
Sure. I mean,
that relationship doesn't exist anymore, and like it is, you know, we have so many different moral panics and avenues for people to be angry about this sort of stuff.
But this is one of the
that I'm not sure. I just don't know who is the warning for.
The MPAA does actually publish really good detailed parents' guides to movies that go beyond the initial stuff that you see in a rating label, and that is useful for people. I mean, at the same screening of Dr. Sleep that we were at, you were upset because there was a parent there with an incredibly young kid.
Yes.
And, you know, look, yes. We don't know what that parent's decision-making process was, but
it was bad.
Yeah, it was bad, but at least if you provide people with detailed, granular information, they can make informed decisions. And that's, I think, as a compromise, if we're going to have a compromise, that is obviously superior to erasing or not making stuff available.
Of course.
Song of the South should be available in Disney+. Maybe people will wander into it, but just purely from an archival perspective, we already know that Disney has been such a bad actor in this perspective that content warnings seem like a reasonable compromise.
Peter, do you think they should pull the Michael Jackson Simpsons episode? Make a judgment call here. Not whether or not they have the right to do it. Should they?
Also, no, obviously. Like, obviously they should not pull it. That's stupid.
I probably not. I mean,
I'm asking you to make a value judgment here. I think not a question of morals and rights.
No,
but
I think if I were the person in charge of making this decision for Disney+, what I would ask is there any evidence? Is there any evidence that leaving this in here in available will do harm to people? And is there any evidence that leaving it up will negatively impact our bottom line? Like, are people going to revolt? Right? Those are the two questions. Are people going to be harmed and are people going to revolt? And I guess I don't know the answer to that question in the way that a manager of that system would.
You're looking at this. The first part of that is, I think, more reasonable than the second. The idea that, you know, people will revolt and will cancel and will complain on social media, I do not think is a valid reason to withhold things, withhold works of art.
Well, and there's also a more information solution to this, too. You can have the episode up, and then before credits, I mean, obviously you have to negotiate this with Matt Groening and everything, put up a title card that says that
there's a lot of contractual agreements with regards to whether you have to, if you're going to post one season, if you have to post the whole thing, or who has the right to sort of edit.
And I think the Simpsons creators may have also pulled it themselves from rotation, which again is, I think, a huge mistake. I think it is weak, and I think it is an effort to cover up what they did in the past.
But the solution that I would offer is, put up a splash card before the end credits that directs people to Leaving Neverland. Say, if you want more context on this, here's this documentary. Like, again, you know, that's the kind of thing where you actually could do some good in terms of directing people to a sort of meticulously researched, reported documentary about all of this that provides wraparound context while still preserving the content.
So, guys, would you say the ability to recreate and erase the past is a controversy? Or a non-troversy?
Controversy, obviously.
Controversy.
It's definitely a controversy. I'm not sure that it's... I think it's the sort of thing that we're going to be talking about for a long time, and there's not going to be an obvious way to... Like, oh, this is the... We've all settled on how to think about this sort of thing. Mm. And thinking about it maybe just a little bit more on your Simpsons question, like, maybe my answer is, it's really not up to me, because it's not my thing.
I wasn't... No, but that is exactly what I was not asking you. I specifically said, I'm asking you to make a value judgment, not a like, question of whether or not you should have the right
but
to
my
do
value
it.
Judgment is that it's the owner's right to decide about their own art, whether they want people to be exposed to it or not.
You people need to get your act together over there at Reason and Cato. Get it together. It's obviously a controversy. All right. In theaters this week is Ford v. Ferrari.
I'm glad we're at the point of blaming the Cato Institute.
Yeah, you know.
Which is lovely, but I do not work for, to be clear.
I'm just lumping all of the libertarians in together. I think that's totally fair. I think that's the guilt by association works in every situation, including this one. All right. In theaters this week is Ford v. Ferrari, Dawn of Le Mans, James Mangold's throwback buddy comedy slash adventure flick, kind of, starring Christian Bale as the gruff and grizzled race car driver Ken Miles, and Matt Damon as a legendary car designer Carroll Shelby. The two team up at the request of Ford exec Lee Iacocca. Lee Iacocca, who is played with Don Draper-esque charm by John Bernthal in this film, who wants the Americans to be able to compete with the legendary Italian car company after Enzo Ferrari, the founder, I think he's the founder, anyway, he's in charge of it at the time, insults Ford's honor. Ford v. Ferrari is, in many ways, a Hollywood throwback. Big stars, chewing scenery, in a formulaic but fun biopic that features white hats and black hats and charm to spare and lots of action, and I quite enjoyed it. But I'm going to be honest with you guys. We saw this about 10 days ago from when we're taping this right now, and I have not thought about it since, really. Except for when I was starting to prepare this script. So it is a fun movie. I don't know that it necessarily resonates with me. Peter, do you think that this movie is going to stick with people? Or is it just a pleasant 2.5 hours in the theater? And is that enough?
I think it's both. It's a very pleasant and frothy and enjoyable and a movie that, like, it's just very entertaining and engaging and to watch. And it's the kind of movie that you can forget if you want to. But I think there's also a lot there to think about and a lot. And this is, in fact, a movie that has stuck with me. And in particular, James Mangold's treatment of kind of male drive and ambition, especially after watching Walk the Line recently. He's really interested in these taciturn men who are haunted by their pasts. And it's always, and the ways that they're always trying to live up to their own very sort of high estimations of themselves. And so you mentioned that the inciting incident in many ways is when the owner of Ferrari insults the head of Ford, Henry Ford II, for not being his father. And that's what drives him. He says all this other stuff, right? He says, oh, you're terrible, you're fat, you're stupid, you're whatever. But, like, no, it's the moment when he says, you're not your father, right? You're Henry Ford II.
Yeah, you're
not
Henry
Ford. Of course
you'll
never.
Yeah.
And that's what drives the whole movie, so to speak, is that there's this sort of male sense of, like, no, I can be more, I am more, right? And that's also true with Matt Damon's character, who is a former race car driver who won the 24 Hours of Le Mans, was the only American to have done it up until the point when the movie starts, and is no longer able to race because of his health concerns. And so in some ways, he's sort of driven to get back into this haunted by his past, right? And he's trying to win again by building a car that can beat Ferrari. And this is a thing that Mangold really does interestingly and does well and gets at the kind of particularly male nature of this sort of ambition. I think you also see it in The Wolverine and even more so in Logan, in which is really about a movie about a guy, even a couple of guys if you count Patrick Stewart's character, Professor X, who are haunted by their pasts. And you can read that almost as like a double movie, sort of as a double for how the ways that Patrick Stewart and Hugh Jackman as actors have been haunted by these roles for the last, you know, 17 or 18 years of their lives. And it's just a sort of fascinating film about male ambition. It's also just so frothy and enjoyable and, like, wonderful. And I love looking at his images and these pictures he has of really beautiful men driving really beautiful cars, almost not doing anything. And there's a little bit of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which also features a lot of Brad Pitt driving around.
A lot of fast driving, yeah. Just in, like, regular streets. Just
I don't
like,
know. Alyssa, kind of did you enjoy the hot men, fast cars, fast men, hot cars, whatever the, like...
So I mean, theoretically could not be less the audience for this movie. I don't care about cars that much, although I do enjoy driving somewhat over the speed limit. I don't know about sort of the technical details of car design at all. I do enjoy a hot man. And I will say that the League of Lady Film Critics is, like, I think we're all feeling sort of confused stirrings about the movie's portrayal of, like, a smoking hot Lee Iacocca.
I want to come back to this in a second because I think it's very fascinating what they're doing with him here. But.
Yes. The movie has stuck with me, but for sort of different reasons, Peter. And I didn't find it as much a movie about sort of men haunted by their past. Like, people have a past and a context. Lee Iacocca noticeably doesn't have the sort of tortured dad thing that everyone else does. But it's a very interesting movie about this sort of central question of whether or not to work within a system and whether the system itself has value. Because the central tension in the movie is between Ford's sort of assembly line approach to making cars, which when the movie starts has gotten it into a fair amount of business trouble, and how and whether sort of individual geniuses can fit inside that system, iterate within that system, and take feedback from that system to a certain extent. Because and the movie.
So you're saying this is a movie. Or this is a movie about movies.
It's a movie about movies. It's a movie about capitalism. But
and a movie about art. And there's a little bit. There's again. This goes back to Walk the Line, which was another movie about a guy who was rebelling against the executives, and also a movie that like Ford v Ferrari was about sort of the mysticism of creation.
But at the same time, one thing we talked about in our discussion of Walk the Line is the fact that it is a movie that presents Johnny Cash as kind of a savant. He's someone who's sort of without agency in terms of his creative process. It's not very interested in the process of songwriting or figuring out music. It's much more interested in the sort of impressionistic portrait of the relationship between Johnny Cash and June Carter. This is a movie that's very much about creation. Like, how do you give feedback? How do you take feedback? One of the things that makes it hugely successful, I think, is that I don't know how to drive stick, but the movie is very good at explaining to you how the various parts of a car work, how they feel when you drive them, how you manage a car in a long-term race like Le Mans, which takes place literally over 24 hours. You have to keep a car moving continuously, basically, with some brakes for refueling, everything else.
And the drivers switch out, as a non-race car fan,
yeah.
This is one thing I never actually understood. About 24 hours of Le Mans, I was like, that can't be safe, having one guy drive for 24 hours. Turns out they have teams. Did not realize that.
But the movie is incredibly good at communicating and dramatizing all of those technical details. And the larger overarching point about whether or not sort of lone geniuses can work in a system like Ford and whether the two can find a way to accommodate each other doesn't work without that sense of details, right? I mean, the movie communicates very clearly that Christian Bale's character, Ken Miles, this very gifted British but mercurial British race car driver, has sort of incredible feel for how the technical details of car design manifest in a really intense driving experience. And so the movie is very fair to a certain extent in showing you both what Ford has to bring to the table, what someone like Miles has to bring to the table, and then what a interlocutor like Iacocca or Carroll Shelby brings to the table in terms of being able to manage both the production supply chain and the people with the money and then the people with the talent. So it's a very good sort of bureaucratic and organizational movie. And part of what makes it good is that it has this huge range of male characters who relate to these systems and these imperatives in different ways. Henry Ford is the second, played by Tracy Letts, is sort of the embodiment of the institutionalist.
Who's so great.
You have Josh Lucas, who was once going to be like a leading man, who's now actually really great in the supporting turn as a kind of evil, stifled Ford executive who wants to prioritize the Ford bureaucracy above everyone else. You have Iacocca, who values Ford, but in part believes that the company has greater potential than it's been showing. And then you have someone like Shelby who recognizes the importance of being able to move in and out of the system.
Yeah. And as I said, it is interesting what they are doing with Iacocca here, because Lee Iacocca, I think, has become a bit of a joke in recent years. I think he is not well liked, certainly not well liked on the left. And I think the right has, thinks of him as a stodgy old timer. And the only other, even relatively recent, it's not even that recent, but the only other recent portrayal of him on film that I can remember is in Watchmen, the Zack Snyder Watchmen, where he is very ceremoniously, I would say, murdered in kind of loving slow-mo detail. In a way that I think is designed to, again, hammer home the, like, look at this guy, he's the worst, Ozymandias, pretty cool, right? And what they do in this movie is they totally turn him into Don Draper. They make him the kind of visionary who has a story to tell about the greatness of Ford and what it means to a generation of teenagers. And like John Bernthal is just like kind of hot and like he's really well put together. And the whole thing is. I would say the most unexpected rehabilitation on film that I can remember. And I mean, liberal Hollywood championing, Lee Iacocca, very unexpected.
But part of what's interesting about that is that the movie Mangold and his casting directors have done a lot of reversals with the casting, right? Bernthal has been, you know, this quasi-villain in The Walking Dead. He was the Punisher. And all of a sudden, he gets to play the sort of, like, sexy, charismatic protagonist. Bale is known for being really intense and exhausting. And here he gets to be funny. I mean, he's still intense. Yeah. But a lot of his scenes are genuinely sort of hilarious.
Yeah.
Josh Lucas is the former sort of sexy leading man who gets to play the, like, kind of corporate stooge. Yeah. He's arguably the villain of the movie. And I think those reversals, there are just too many of them for it to be completely unintentional. It just seems to me like that was something that they kind of wanted to do. And it lends a lot of snap to the movie, I think.
Well, it certainly allows it underlines the performances and how good they are, because these aren't just good in the performances in the normal mode. Virtually all of the actors, with the exception of maybe Tracy Letts, are basically playing types that we're not used to seeing them play. And so what that does is it says, this isn't just a good performance the way that you've always assumed that Christian Bale can deliver a good sort of moody, brooding, intense performance. No, he's actually light and funny. He's really sort of a wild character. There's a lot more going on here. And Bale, in many ways, runs away with the movie. Yeah.
Somebody describe his performance as the most gif-able of the year. It is the movie most likely to inspire a series of reaction gifs.
Yeah, he's like super rubber-faced in it. I mean, he almost has that like kind of Jim Carrey-ish quality of just like anything can happen on that mug. And that's not something I think people associate with Bale at all.
And there's a volatility to it that you sort of almost expect to like burst into violence. And then there's this wonderful, wonderful moment, maybe two-thirds of the way through the film, in which he is told that because of the Josh Lucas character, he's being not allowed to race in a big, important race. And you sort of expect, like, the movie has set you up to expect him to blow up and to just throw a fit, right? I mean, he has, like, thrown wrenches. There's, you know, he's a very mercurial guy. And instead, he pretty much says, okay, well, here are the changes you should make to the car in advance. And then he stays in the garage and listens to the race as his wife comes in. And they sort of listen, you know, and they listen to the race together. And you can see him just following along in his mind, right? He's playing the race in his head as if he's in the car, right? Sort of talking along quietly, slowly. And it's this wonderful little quiet moment that shows that, again, I mean, it's a very James Mangold approach to masculinity, which is that these guys, the mercuriality and the sort of the difficulty is real. And like we won't in some ways, you know, we won't say these people aren't difficult. On the other hand, they're actually kind of gentle souls. And he doesn't like male volatility to burst into violence all the time, which is very different than, say, Martin Scorsese.
But it does burst into violence several times here. This is the most masculine movie of the award season, I feel pretty comfortable saying.
Yeah.
This is the movie that is most likely to resonate with people who like are looking for that kind of Eastwood.
Well, I can totally
Scorsese
I
fits.
Can also totally see an award season in which there are Ford versus Ferrari blocks and Little Women blocks, and then like Joker swoops in.
Oh no!
Well, Joker is a different kind of masculinity. I
it
think
is
you know.
Indeed.
But of course, Joker is the better movie because it makes you think it's a real work of art. Sui generis.
See, that's a controversy.
That sort
yeah,
of
that's
thing.
A controversy.
That sort of thing we can talk about another time. So, you guys, what do we say here, Alyssa? Thumbs up or thumbs down?
Totally thumbs up.
Peter,
I loved it.
I thumbs up. I quite enjoyed it. Very fun. Again, I'm curious to see if I ever have a desire to revisit it. We'll see. All right. Now we move to assigned viewing. Assigned viewing for this week is Martin Scorsese's Casino, his 3-hour opus about the rise and fall of the Tangiers Casino in Las Vegas. Peter, why are we watching Casino today?
We are watching Casino in preparation for Martin Scorsese's new movie, The Irishman. Casino stars Robert De Niro as Sam Rothstein, a sports handicapper and mafia middle manager, basically, who gets sent to Las Vegas to run the Tangiers Casino. Despite lacking a gaming license, he succeeds in making the casino much more profitable, at which point the Midwest mafia bosses say, you've got to work with your friend Nicky Santoro, who's played by Joe Pesci. Santoro is an extremely volatile, violent mob enforcer whose bad behavior puts the whole Tangiers operation at risk.
Along the way, Rothstein falls in love with Ginger McKenna, played by Sharon Stone. She's a kind of a Vegas hustler who charms him, but also funnels money to her shady ex, Lester Diamond, who's played with delightful, over-the-top ickiness by future Trump booster James Woods. The movie is gritty, great, incredibly stylish. It's about business and love and violence and bad tempers, poor life choices, perfectionism, why gambling regulations don't really work, and the incredibly finicky nature of blueberry muffins. If there is a prevailing criticism of this movie, it's that it's a retread of Scorsese's previous mob epic, Goodfellas, which came out just a few years before. And I think there's certainly some overlap. Both films were written by Nicholas Pileggi, and both, like The Irishman, starred De Niro and Joe Pesci. But I think it's a mistake to see it as Scorsese simply repeating himself. It is an expansion and a reworking of many of the same themes and ideas, in particular, male psychological volatility, which seems to be the theme today, as well as the ways that violence and greed made these mobsters both good at what they did and also kind of proved to be their undoing. And so in a way, it reminds me of Scorsese's King of Comedy, which strangely felt like a belated follow-up to Taxi Driver, in that both films cast De Niro as a psychologically frail social outcast whose inability to fit in and find healthy community led to an act of antisocial violence. Scorsese often likes to make these kind of diptychs, these pairs of movies that explore the same themes. And in particular, one of the things that connects all of these movies, going back to Taxi Driver, going back to King of Comedy, is that even though they're really male movies, about male psychological issues, they're also very interested in female characters and how male bad behavior affects them. Alyssa, I know that you were fascinated, as I think rightly, by Sharon Stone's performance in this movie. What did you think about that, and sort of how do you feel like it fits into Scorsese's overall view of women? I mean, going back to Taxi Driver and Sybil Shepherd, which, you know, we're really meant to understand that De Niro's character, Travis Bickle, is not behaving appropriately, and is having a negative, like an understandably deeply negative effect on her.
So I had not seen Casino before this, as we will see is the case with a lot of these sort of super male movies that we end up discussing on the podcast. And it's a fascinating movie in a lot of ways, not least because the first hour of it is basically a real well-written Wikipedia entry.
Yeah, it's like it is a how Vegas works.
Exactly.
Like how to. It's amazing.
And I think the best scene in it is the one that introduces Ginger and shows her sort of paying off people, understanding the whole sort of architecture of the casino system. Where I think the movie doesn't do as good a job is in sort of understanding her backstory, right? Because she has this relationship with Lester who, it's not quite said a lot, but it's clear pimped her out.
Yes. Probably underage, as
yes,
a child.
Like yeah. Quite a young yeah. person. And she ends up putting her daughter in danger, both in proximity to him and to be with him. And the movie never quite nails where that relationship comes from. You get that it's very powerful. I mean, the scene during her wedding when, you know, she's theoretically supposed to be celebrating with Sam, who she's made this kind of arrangement with, and she's actually off in, you know, the hall phone crying to Lester on the phone. You see the depth of that pull, but you don't really understand why it exists. And given that the movie doesn't shy away from sort of depictions of drug use and alcoholism, that it definitely doesn't sort of shy away from hyperviolence, it's almost a little dainty about sort of sex in Vegas.
Well, Scorsese has always been dainty about sex, for the most part.
But this is something where he's putting at the center of his movie a really sexually damaging relationship and yet is not really comfortable addressing it.
Mm.
I mean, he wants it to be there, but he doesn't really want to have to talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is more just a function of her being a secondary character. I mean, the movie's
absolutely
already 3 hours long as it is.
No, and I'm not really complaining about it. I'm just saying that, you know, if we're talking about that, the treatment of women in this context, there's an interesting sort of daintiness about that. But it is sort of a fascinating movie because, and I hadn't really thought about this going in, it's about the mob, but it's a mob movie where the standard non-Italian character is actually sort of at the center, right? And I mean, I think that Sam and Nicky are arguably co-protagonists, But it's, you know, you have Tom Hagen in the Godfather movies who can never be all the way in because he's Irish. In The Sopranos, you have Hesh. So you have the sort of Jewish advisor in Money Man. And this is a movie about, again, like it's a mob movie, but it's about the Jewish guy who's working for the mob.
But all of Scorsese's mob movies are like that. I mean, yeah. The Irishman is literally The Irishman.
No,
I mean,
the
Goodfellas is about a guy who's half Sicilian, and so can never be made, and also another Irishman.
No, you know? Indeed. But it's very interesting how the movie is not just interested in women, but in this sort of undercurrent of anti-Semitism, right? I mean, Nicky and Sam are supposed to be like boyhood friends, incredibly close, and it's the souring of this relationship. But there is always this undercurrent of contempt. You know, he doesn't go all the way over into, you know, calling him the slur that you might have expected him to use, but he's constantly talking about him like as the Jew or his Jewishness. And it's just a very, you know, to the extent that it's kind of a three-hander, it's the insider, one kind of outsider, and another kind of outsider.
I'm a big fan of this movie in large part because I find Ace Rothstein to be the most interesting of the Scorsese protagonists. And I don't know that I would even limit this necessarily to the gangster films, though certainly amongst the gangster films, he is, I think, the most interesting protagonist because he envisions what he's the only one who wants to go straight.
Yeah.
He just wants to do what he does very well, which is run books.
Yeah.
Right? He wants to run numbers and set lines and do sports book betting. And he wants to run the casino and he wants to be a member of society. This is why what the you know, big issue at the heart of the film is actually a weirdly arcane legal battle about whether or not he can legally be allowed to run the casino. And he can't because he's got a criminal background and because he insults the Nevada gaming commissioners and all that. But like the whole heart of Sam Rothstein is that he wants a family. He wants a house. He wants to be in the country club. He wants people to respect him. He wants to be a like legit member of society while also just kind of happening to be, you know, propped up by murderers. Well, by murderers and killers and like awful people.
And
you know?
It's a very interestingly sentimental movie. I mean, before he marries Ginger, he sort of makes this arrangement with her where he says, look, I think you're probably going to fall in love with me over time. You know, affection will grow. And he really appears to believe that. And she clearly never does.
Well, he has no self-awareness, which is like another thing I find very interesting about Sam Rothstein is that, like, again, everybody else in the Scorsese movies kind of, I think, has a decent sense of who they are and what they're doing.
Well, and Nicky does, too.
Nicky certainly does. Nicky, like, actually is, in a weird way, the conscience of the movie because he understands, you know, he says it, we're here to rob and steal. We came to Vegas to rob and steal these people blind. And the fact that I'm not allowed to do this is, you know, ridiculous. Yeah. And, you know, you gotta back me on this.
Robbing people by setting odds certain ways.
So he understands what they're doing out there, I think, in a more realistic way than Sam does. But it's the scene with the blueberries and the blueberry muffins that is like, I think the most relatable scene I've ever seen in a Scorsese movie
where because those blueberries are like semicolons.
The guy is, you know, he's trying to run this whole thing. And everything he encounters is a small thing that is wrong. Like the craps dealer who's like putting the checks out wrong, or the Billy Joe Bob Briggs who like has the slot machines in the wrong place. Like everywhere.
Or the dealer who's
finally,
tipping the hands.
Or the dealer, and then finally he finds something that like just makes him explode, and it's the fact that his blueberry muffin doesn't have any blueberries in it. And I'm like, I get that, I can empathize with that very strongly.
In a way, this is the perfect movie to discuss with Ford versus Ferrari, you know, putting aside The Irishman, because it's a second movie about a perfectionist trying to work within a system, but unlike Ford versus Ferrari, he's working within a system that he doesn't entirely understand and that he is not entirely, you know, he's very talented at it, but he is blocked in some fundamental way from mastering it.
Yeah.
This is why I called him a middle manager when I, you know, was introducing his character, is because that's what he is. He is a good upper middle manager.
Yeah.
And there's this weird sense in which all the other mob characters are sort of like crazy mob cartoon, you know, sort of mafia. Even the bosses back home, right, are kind of ridiculous.
They're keeping ridiculous ledgers. I mean, they're taking notes on a criminal effing conspiracy.
Right. You know, there's a business aspect to what they're doing, but they're not running a business, and that's all he's doing. It is interesting, though, that you point out how unself-aware he is about how the world sees him, about who he is, about his place in all of this. And to me, you think of, you know, you said that that's sort of unusual, but I think that's actually the role that De Niro always gets cast in Scorsese movies. If you go back to Taxi Driver and King of Comedy,
he is somebody who
doesn't understand who he is and what his place is in the world. In King of Comedy in particular, just a deep sort of inability to comprehend other people see him and the social signals that they are sending.
There's a difference there in that those guys are like essentially crazy. And in many ways, correct, Sam Rothstein is like the most sane person in this movie. Like he has fooled himself in a way that I don't think the other two quite do, because they're not trying to fool themselves. They are like they just exist. They are just like in the world. Like agents of chaos, you know?
It's necessary for him to fool himself in order to get that that country club, you know, nicely married, all the bedspreads match, life that he wants.
It's poignant rather than scary, right? I mean, he's not so far miscalibrated as to take Ginger to a porn theater on their first date, like Travis Bickle does in Taxi Driver, but he is miscalibrated enough to see her as someone who can be conventional. When she's clearly just not. And again, even if the movie had done like a little bit more to illustrate the extent to which like she's not just like a hustler, she's like profoundly miswired in some way, that might have landed a little bit harder. I mean, there's a little bit of a savior complex in there. But yeah, he's poignant rather than frightening.
All right. Next week's assigned viewing will be Brick, Rian Johnson's mannered high school noir, in preparation for Rian Johnson's mannered whodunit, Knives Out. That's it for Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Rebeller. Please go to rebellermedia.com and sign up for a membership. It's cheaper than a Patreon, and you get more stuff. And if you don't sign up, we don't get to keep doing this. So if you love the show, tell your friends and review us at Apple. We need those reviews, people. If you didn't love it, complain to me personally on Twitter at SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sonny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman. Produced by Sonny Bunch and Natasha Passetta. Executive producer, Dallas Sonnier. Associate producer, Jessica Safavamare. Art and design by Jason Koslerich. Sound recording, design, and mixing by Sonny Bunch, with music by James Malone.